Welcome to Truth Talk for Conscious Entrepreneurs. This is your host, Emma Churchman. Welcome to a limited series I've created titled Cleared for Profit, Heal Your Trauma to Grow Your Business, where I interview experts on how trauma informs your business.
Y'all, I am so delighted to have Irene Lyon with us today. She's a nervous system specialist and therapeutic coach who helps everyone from the mom next door to the next big thought leaders transform their bodies, businesses, relationships, and lives through regulating their nervous system. So she helps people release their deepest traumas from their nervous systems, which allows them to finally heal from chronic mental, physical, and emotional conditions that they have tried everything to fix. So Irene uses the same tools to help entrepreneurs break through the mental, physical, and emotional blocks that arise when taking big leaps in their businesses. And I'm especially excited about that because you all are conscious entrepreneurs. So Irene has intensively studied and practiced the work of Dr. Feldenkrais, Peter Levine, who's the founder of Somatic Experiencing, and Kathy Kane, who's the founder of Somatic Practice. So she has a master's degree in research in the fields of biomedical and health science. Welcome, Irene.
Hi there. Hi, Emma. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, glad to have you. So tell us where you are in the world today.
Yeah, I am at this moment sitting in my home in beautiful Vancouver, British Columbia, Canada. For those who know Vancouver, I live in an area called Kitsilano Point, which is in probably one of the nicest spots, right on the water, view of the mountains, the ocean. It's quiet, a good spot. I was born and raised here.
Oh, lovely. Mm-hmm. And I'm so curious, Irene, because I've been following you for a while with what you do with helping people regulate the nervous system. And I started checking you out on YouTube, checking out your programs when I started working with my own autonomic nervous system. Mm-hmm. What inspired you to start doing that work?
Well, it wasn't direct. I'll give you my origin story, if you will. I first studied exercise science, so that's kind of why I've got those fancy letters, masters, and all that. But I was really into the human body and rehabilitating it. I had gotten, living in British Columbia, I was a very avid skier, downhill skier, and had a series of injuries in my late teens and early 20s that led me to get surgeries and have to do the good old physical therapy rehab route, which I'm sure many people listening to this have had to do at some point. And I loved it, actually. And that's what got me into studying exercise science and fitness. And then there was a specific injury that was really bad, where I actually broke my kneecap, believe it or not, my patella. And that required a more hefty surgery. And after that one, my body was kind of, I call it out of whack. I don't know if you know that saying, but it was just kind of all messed up. And even though I was doing everything I had done that I was taught in like 7 years of university and training, I wasn't getting better. And I kind of was like, I just studied for 7 years to help people do these things, and I can't even figure it out on my own, even with all this great training. So it was a bit strange, but frustrating. I was lucky enough at the time, this is when I actually was introduced to Feldenkrais, which is a very sophisticated form of mind, body, movement, re-education. That's a whole other podcast for us, Emma. But his work really, for lack of a better word, cured me. So it was a physical therapist who said, you know, something's not right here. You're strong. You are in alignment. You can do everything you need to do. There's no deficiencies, but your body is just like wound up like a toy. He said, there's a lot of tension. There's a lot of stress. I want you to go see this person who does Feldenkrais. So I went and did that, and it literally changed everything. It retaught me how to move again and how to not hold tension in the patterns that I had really gotten from having to protect my knee joints during the surgery. So the long story short of that is I was like, this is amazing. I have to learn how to do this, right? And so I studied the Feldenkrais method for 4 years. And I loved it, and I started practicing. And then I came up to the next question mark, because there were a lot of people in my practice who were getting better, kind of like I did. But there was a lot of people who weren't. And I felt like I had a pretty good toolbox with all the training I had done, but I was still missing something. And this is where the trauma piece came in. And the reason I knew something was up was I was seeing, it was actually, believe it or not, a specific week in 2008. Who knows if the gods sent me all these clients that week to kind of give me a shake. But a lot of the people I had seen that week had had really bad accidents. And by bad, I mean like not just breaking a bone, like being in propane explosions, falling off of cliffs onto their backs and still surviving, and you know, horrific childhood abuse, like all these things. And they came in with these physical ailments. I'd work from the lens of the physical and even the mind body, but I'd do something, they might feel a bit better. And then by the end of the session or the next week, everything kind of was wound back up and just like it was before. Does that make sense? Like it was like, what have I done? Mm-hmm. And then I kind of, being the inquisitive scientific person I am, started asking around, like, what am I missing? And thankfully, a colleague of mine who also was a Feldenkrais practitioner said, you might want to check out this work by Peter Levine. And he does something called somatic experiencing. And looked it up, read a little bit, and was like, okay, I guess this is my next training. And that was in 2008. And to this day, I'm still attending Peter's master classes. I've been fortunate enough to assist at his high-level trainings. I've done more work with some of his colleagues, and it's been kind of green light ever since. And then that's really how I got into this trauma piece. So it wasn't for my own system necessarily, it was for my clients. But just like anything, as I got into the work, and we'll probably talk about this a little later, is I realized, holy cow, I actually have a lot of stored up trauma in my system that I had no idea about. And then that was where it got really interesting. And I started to kind of look at our society as a whole, not just entrepreneurs, but like the collective, and went, wow, like we're all kind of still asleep to this concept. So that's the short version, believe it or not.
So Irene, how do you define trauma?
Sure. Mm-hmm. Well, I define it based on how I was taught. And this is more of a definition from the world of somatic experiencing. But I think that if you start talking to people who are experts in this field, and the field is called the new traumatology for those that are interested, we would define it as basically nervous system dysregulation. So by that, I mean, we have many nervous systems. So the term nervous system is now kind of getting thrown around like gratitude did a while ago, and love, like we just use it, but we don't really know what it means. The nervous system is not just one thing, and maybe we can dive into the branches if you want a little later, but The autonomic nervous system is one branch of our nervous systems. And within that branch, there are two branches, and then within one of those branches, there's another two branches and another two branches. So it's quite complex. But for simplicity's sake, we have our fight, flight, and freeze branches of the autonomic nervous system. And when those branches are stuck in protection, that's the best way to say it. So they are sensing a threat. They're sensing something isn't right. And this can be real, like someone, say, living in a crappy situation, or they're in a war zone, or they don't have enough to survive. Like, that's like extreme. The system is on alert. Interestingly enough, let's say someone is living in a fairly safe environment. Like right now, I'm sitting in my lovely home, and Kit Tulano, you're probably sitting in a safe home where you are. And we could say there's no immediate threat. Would you agree? I'll just kind of ask you that question.
Yes. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. There's no like dogs running into your place, and there's no, you know, helicopters overhead, things like that. So we're in a fairly relatively safe situation. The thing that's interesting is that if we had had earlier traumas, not just in childhood, but say in, when we were in utero, when we were infants, when we were children, when we were teenagers, when we were in our early 20s, 30s, that were quite shocking and quite threatening to our systems. If we don't resolve that traumatic response or those traumatic responses, because it's usually plural, our system, our autonomic nervous system, will still think we are under threat. And so if we're living in a state of that kind of perceived danger and threat, which many people are, the system becomes what we call dysregulated. And this is where then we say trauma is not in the event per se. It's not in the accident. It's not in the abuse. It's not in the war. It's in the nervous system, because there's a lot of folks who might have a traumatic event, or what we would call a traumatic event, like say a car accident. Some people will walk away from that and not end up getting, let's say, PTSD, but someone else will walk away from that exact same car accident and they will end up with PTSD. They'll never be able to get into a car again. They'll end up getting chronic fatigue, et cetera, pain. And so that's kind of why we know that the event is not so much the issue, it's how a person stores that event in their nervous system, and then how that storage dysregulates the nervous system. And then when the nervous system is dysregulated, it kind of sets the body-mind interface up for illness, for lack of a better word. And then that illness can come out in a myriad of ways,
Do you? Yeah, you're totally making sense.
Okay.
And of course, I immediately go to, okay, so let's talk about the patterns that show up in the nervous system. Do you see any patterns specifically for entrepreneurs?
Well, we have to first realize that an entrepreneur is a human being, right? And that everyone's going to be different, because of our genetics, because of our environment, the type of influences we had on our systems. If someone, and so I say that kind of loosely, because a lot of people will say, well, when a person has stored trauma, they get PTSD. Like, they'll just, you know, as a blanket statement. Or when someone has stored up trauma, they end up with a mental illness. What we know is that depending on your genetic predisposition, the genetics play a part here. If the system is living in this survival mode, and survival mode doesn't have to look like all anxiety-ridden and not able to function. It can also be, and this is very common in the entrepreneurial space, they can be very much in what we call a freeze state, so there's fight, flight, freeze. Freeze isn't necessarily non-functional. we can have high functional freeze where a person is so driven and so in control and so perfection driven, and we could say workaholic, like getting everything done, all the dots and T's, you know, dotted and crossed and everything's perfect. And that actually can be a sign of a coping mechanism to not feel. And often in that entrepreneurial space, and I'm in it, I know many people who are, our patterns that kept us safe when we were young can actually be patterns that can create a lot of success as adults. The thing that's interesting is that sooner or later, the system, the body system, can only go on for so long. And then usually something cracks. Something will seep through, whether it's, you know, someone might get into something like a car accident that isn't life-threatening by any means, but it's enough of a jolt, Emma, to kind of break the egg open, so to speak. A family member could die. A relationship could end, bankruptcy, you know, money could go away. And a lot of these stressors can be sort of this, the straw that broke the camel's back. And then a person can then become completely debilitated, even though they were high functioning up until that point. The image that I'd love to bring to you and your listeners is if you think about a glass of water or a big mason jar of water that's like full to the brim, right? And that water in that cup or jar is all the stored traumatic stress, all the stored threat, all the times that we've overridden our emotions, not had that cry when we needed to, not set boundaries when we had to. It could have been, you know, so much, so many things. And we're going along just fine with this very full cup. And then all of a sudden there's this external traumatic event or shock trauma, which we would call it, which would be something like an accident or a loved one dying or, you know, losing a lot of money, for example. And it's sort of like it cracks that cup or that jar, and then all the water just spills. And it's kind of, it creates this perfect, like this disaster. When that happens, if that happens, I don't want anyone to have that happen to them, but if that happens, the genetic predisposition that we have will often play out. So that could be digestive problems, that could be insomnia, that could be depression, that could be an autoimmune condition, that could be a skin condition. So many things could pop up once that system finally can't. It's kind of like it's sort of, I get this image of a person like on a ledge and they've been like holding on to this building. I often see in images, and you know, their muscles are tired, but they've been able to kind of hold on. Because there's not a lot of bad weather, but then as soon as a storm comes in and, you know, rattles them, they use more effort and more force to hold on to that building. But then there's a point at which there's this gust and it just throws them off and they can't hold on anymore. So often I would say that that's what I have seen, especially in high-level entrepreneurs. And then in the lower-level entrepreneurs who are just working really hard, they might get little bits of this and they just clock it up to, oh, I'm not getting enough sleep, or my diet's not very good, or I haven't been exercising, or oh, you know, it's just been a hard month. It'll change. I don't know if you've ever heard people talk in that term. Maybe you have, I'm not sure. So that's kind of how we see it. It's funny. It's not really anything super special for entrepreneurs. And yet the general way is it's someone highly functioning who's been going, and then something happens, and then it just kind of blows the person apart.
Right.
There are other examples, right, but I'll end at that and see if you have any questions around that.
Yeah, that
beautiful, actually, and that ties into something I've been talking about recently mm-hmm. with my tribe, which is this pattern of being in the pushing, the hustling, driving to grow mm-hmm. the business. And mm-hmm. some entrepreneurs can do that until they get to six figures, multi-six figures, even mm-hmm. a seven-figure business. And then mm-hmm. all of a sudden, it stops working. And yeah. they stop being able to function. They are burnt out. They're resentful. They hate mm-hmm. their clients. They hate their business. and the physicality of it catches up with them. Like they go in for emergency surgery or something else like that
yeah.
to trip them up. And yeah. so I'm always saying to my people, this is about building a sustainable model, not staying in this. I love that example of the freeze response, the high functional mm-hmm. freeze response, in order to get to what you think is success. And then you deal with this stuff. You actually have to deal with this stuff as you go. Could you speak into that a little bit?
Yeah, well, the thing that popped up as you were talking is, you said the word hustle, which I do like that word. And the thing that's interesting, so this is where we actually might need to talk about early trauma. You're keen to talk about that, and developmental trauma. And the reason why is because, and you said there was some buzz. I'm going to just name the words. I wrote them down while you were saying. One was you said people start hating their clients. They need a sustainable model, right? The one thing I've really seen is that if there's some kind of earlier traumatic thing, and by that I mean, and this is one of those topics where when you hear this, it might pierce through in a real tender way, because this might be actually what some of your listeners are living and they don't know it. So I'm going to say this and just really stay connected to your body as I say this, if you can feel the ground under your feet. But let's say we're born healthy, and actually quite healthy. But there is this drive from our parents, or let's say mom and dad didn't really like each other, which is sadly very common. And so the child has to start to do things to stay safe. So there's no abuse or anything like that. There's plenty of food. There's a roof over our heads. But we're on kind of eggshells. And even as an infant, we will feel when something isn't right in our environment. And so very early, we start to suppress. We start to hold in. We start to give our parents what they want. In other words, we're that good girl or that good boy. We never rock the boat. Or maybe we're the opposite. Maybe we're little shit disturbers because we're trying to get attention. Right. And then we get into trouble, and that's our way of getting love. Or it could be that nobody really paid attention to us and there was no emotional connection. It was all very PC, all very stiff British upper lip. I don't know if you know that saying down in the States, but in Canada, because we're part of the Commonwealth, we call that very, you know, everything is fine kind of mm-hmm. sense. Yeah. Mm-hmm. But we're not like that as humans. Like, we have got emotions and we need to be authentic and raw and be primal and be angry sometimes and sad and joyful. You know, kids, you have a child that's free. They play, they dance, they sing, they make up funny stories. Like, that's what a human being really is. We're very creative. So if we have a parental system or a school system, which most of us grew up in some way, shape, or form, where we had to be very controlled, very proper, not rock the boat, essentially not threaten our livelihood, we're going to get really good at knowing how to please people and knowing how to stay safe. And one common thing I've seen, this I'm generalizing, but it's very common, is I see a lot of people go into business, and especially in the healing world or in coaching worlds where you're helping people, which is what you do, it's what I do, they do it because they're looking for recognition. They're looking for someone to say, wow, you just helped me so much. healers get into this trap where they're helping people heal, and then their livelihood and their sense of self is wrapped up in people getting better. And it's a very fine line, because someone might be like, well, I love helping people, right? I love getting people to their goals, and whether it's making money or getting healthier in their lifestyle. And I think that's all fine and well, but it's a very fine line when that entrepreneur, that businesswoman, the healer, whoever, is doing it just for that, so that they can feel good when they hear a success story or when someone makes X amount of dollars. And often those patterns from early on, where we had to get straight A's, we had to do all these things, they follow us into adulthood. And if we are driven with our businesses with that in mind, or with that often unconsciously in our mind, in ourselves, sooner or later something will crack, because we can't keep up with that level. We just can't keep up with that level. Some do. But often under that, there's often a lot of sadness, a lot of anger, a lot of pain that's driving that need to get recognition. We could call it the ego. You know, our ego is being fed. But essentially, how I see this play out with folks is they burn out because the drive isn't internal. So in other words, it's looking for that external pat on the back. And a lot of times people are like, well, what's wrong with some recognition? And we could say nothing. But what we're even seeing in the research is that when children are praised for a good job done when they're young, that's actually detrimental for them, because they're never being driven by their internal process of feeling good about themselves internally. It's always coming from the outside. Does that make sense?
Yeah, hello? I just needed to take that in for a minute, and I want to repeat it back, because that's going to resonate with a lot of people.
Mm-hmm.
So when children are praised for a job well done, they're never driven by their internal system.
Sense of self. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. By their own sense of self.
Yeah.
That's very powerful.
And there's a great book. I'm not just making that up either. This is research that's shown this. There's a book called Nurture Shock by Poe Bronson. And it dives into a lot of this. And I forget that he has a quote at the front of his book, something that goes like, if we tell Johnny he did a good job on that whatever test, we're basically ruining him for life. And it seems a bit like that's a shock. Like, that's why they called the book Nurture Shock, I think. It's like, what? Like, we're taught to be praised when we eat all our vegetables, when we get that A, when we win that trophy. And there's nothing wrong with working hard and doing a job well done. If we didn't do that, we'd be in trouble as a society. But it's when it's only driven so that someone else can say, wow, you're amazing. And the reason why we often are driven for that recognition is because this goes way back, Emma, to when we were like babies. If we didn't have good attunement from our caregivers, our primary caregivers, the child, the infant, will be looking for that recognition, for that knowing that I am okay, that I am safe, that I am okay just the way I am. This is a big topic, but it's interesting how those early, early years really form how we seek out connection. And if we had to seek out, if our connection patterns with our primary caregivers were driven by conditions, we then, if we don't change anything, if we're not aware of these patterns, our adult life, our teenage life will be driven by conditions. And this gets wrapped up into everything from body image to how we take care of ourselves, and then, of course, how we do business. So I'm curious, what did something spark in your mind around your, the way that you work with your people with that one?
You know, it's interesting. There are a handful of core wounds that I tend to see in the people that are attracted to coach with me or be a part of my community. One is a wound of abandonment.
Yes.
And another is a wound of betrayal. And those are often early childhood wounds where it's made very clear that the caregiver or whomever is not available to be present. And then with the betrayal that from my own journey, and I hear this reflected in my clients, it's this belief that our needs do not matter.
Yes. That's so true. And those two words, I'll speak to those, because when someone hears the word abandonment, they might be like, well, I was never left on a sidewalk, you know, like I was in my home, you know, people were there. But one of the one classic, very common thing, and I'm, you know, I know friends of mine 20 years ago who raised their kids this way, and it still happens, where children or babies are left to cry themselves to sleep, right? It was once thought, and still many do think, the only way a child or an infant will learn how to soothe themselves is if they're just left alone in their crib and they cried out until they conk out, literally. And that is one way in which we get imprinted with this sense of abandonment, because when you are young, like three and under, you don't have the mechanisms to self-soothe. They're not, this is where human beings are really strange and we're really complex, because when we're born, we're actually not fully developed, right? This is why a baby can't just be left like a baby calf, you know, in, you know, at a farm, like they don't just stand up right away and know what to do. And so when an infant is born, it needs a primary caregiver, an adult, or at least someone that's older, to teach it how to soothe. And in that process, as it's called attunement, we then, as an infant, learn how to form our nervous system to bring our nervous system down out of that sympathetic arousal, that fight, flight kind of qualities. But because this story is so unknown, it's like, oh, just leave them. They'll be fine. They'll figure it out. But they actually won't. And then what happens is when a little one is left to cry themselves to sleep, they then default into that freeze state. So they actually don't fall asleep because they've soothed themselves. They've fallen asleep because they've gone into a light level shock state, because their system has just been so wired that the only thing it can do is shut down. That makes sense? That abandonment piece?
Whoa, that's a paradigm shift for me, and certainly for who are going to be listening. Whoa. Yeah, two things that I heard in that. One, that we were not born already understanding how to regulate our own nervous systems.
Nope. Not there. It is not there. This is why a little baby can do really well at pooping, peeing, and eating, right? Granted, they're born full term. You know, this is where if somebody, and I'll just say this because there's probably someone listening here who's born premature, someone who's born premature and doesn't have, let's say, their digestive system, their immune system, their lungs working, they're even more compromised, because that shouldn't have happened. Right. It should have waited until the system was fully baked, I call it that, so that when they came out, those autonomic systems that are governed by the autonomic nervous system just know how to work. But the thing that is unique about humans is we have this huge higher brain, right, that is high functioning. And when we're born, a portion of our nervous system that's called there's a few portions, but it's called the part of the parasympathetic. It's called the ventral branch of the parasympathetic. This is where the vagus nerve comes into play. You've heard of the vagus nerve. And and so the vagus nerve has a few functions. One of them is social engagement. So you and I are talking, you're hearing my voice. If we were on a talk with video, my facial expressions would give you cues. You know, if I all of a sudden had a look of terror on my face, you would probably pick that up, right? And maybe that was a sign that, oh, shoot, someone's knocking on my door. I have to, you know, sorry for the interruption. Like, you would see these social cues, these facial cues, and you, if you have a healthy nervous system, which I can, you know, you do, you would perk up and be like, is everything okay, Irene? Or if you had a look on your face that didn't look good, I would ask you, is everything okay, Emma? Like, what's going on? That is attunement. And we don't have that when we're born. We learn it based on how our primary caregiver, usually our mother, but it could be a nanny, it could be a grandma, it could be a father, how they attune to us. So if you have an adult who's taking care of a little one who doesn't have good social skills on their own accord because they had trauma, it then will be passed on to that little one because they can't attune. And this is one of the biggest epidemics I see that's rarely talked about, is this inability for adult humans to know how to attune to infants. And it's not like to blame anyone. It's usually because they weren't taught proper attunement skills when they were young, or they didn't do anything as adults to change it, to rewire it, to grow new patterns. And so when a little one is born, they need that person to hear our cries, because the baby has different cries based on what's wrong. And it's listening to those cries and then attending to them immediately that lets us know that we're safe and someone is there. If that person isn't, like, a parent could be there but not attuned. Does that make sense? Like it's that classic, you know, you see it on, you know, where there maybe is no experience with babies, which is so common in our Western world because we don't have cousins and babies all over the place. But, you know, you see, usually it's a man, sorry guys, but usually man is given a baby, it holds it out in front of it with stiff arms, like, what do I do with this thing, right? And that's because there isn't that knowing of how to listen and how to nurture and be soft with that little one. So that's one way in which we really little, before we even have cognition on board, feel like we're being abandoned, that someone isn't listening to us, and also that we're being betrayed. It's like, hey, I am hungry right now. I'm crying my cry of hunger, and you're putting me to bed. Like, what's up with that, you know? And so an infant isn't thinking that because they don't have the cognition to think it yet. But there is a somatic feeling inside that says, something isn't right. I'm damn hungry. You've just betrayed me because you've walked out of the room. Where are you? And so that's where, believe it or not, these qualities of feeling betrayed and abandoned, they follow with us. And sometimes, or more often than not, a lot of the times, we don't know why we're feeling this, because we're like, no, my parents were there. You know, we had money, we had food. But what often isn't looked at is those early, early wounds. The other common one, I'll just put this in because it's so common, I see it with toddlers and children, is when they're put into time out, when they're told to go to their room, when they're crying. You know, in school, how many times, I know I grew up in a school system where you were put in the corner, you know, or go to the cloakroom, like these sorts of things for punishment. What that does is that also is an abandonment situation where you're being literally shunned away from your pack, from safety, and told to be isolated. And we do this to children thinking it's going to teach them a lesson, but actually it makes things worse. And then it's kind of this sense of, this is a betrayal. Like, I need you. I don't feel well. I'm upset. I don't know what to do with these emotions. And you're telling me to go sit in a room alone. That's not how human beings are meant to be nurtured. So believe it or not, all these early patterns, they get strung along with us. And unfortunately, behavioral therapy and using mindsets to change these patterns will not cut it, because these patterns were wired at the unconscious autonomic nervous system level. All right, I'll stop talking for a second.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes. And I'm right there with you that there's only so much talk therapy that we can do.
Yeah.
To address this stuff. And what you're lifting up, I mean, every single example that you gave, I thought, yes, when I was in school in the 1970s and 80s, yes, all of those things happened. The parenting approach. How many people in my generation have had these experiences?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I talked to my dad. He's in his 70s now, and my mother's in her almost 80s. And the you know, like when you did something bad, you got the ruler, you know, you were slapped, you were hit. It was just kind of clocked up to discipline. And the interesting thing and the sad thing is it does work, because there's a part of us that if we realize we're not going to win by being truly human, which is fully creative and in essence in our bodies, we will then revert to being more like animals that don't have that higher, that fully developed higher brain. And this is where conditioning comes in, right? We can condition, and we've done it in our industrialized society, we've conditioned people to be certain ways in an effort to keep things very much of that industrial complex, right? And we're kind of veering off a little bit here, but that's where our ideals and how we work and our work ethic is really ingrained in us. And a certain degree of that is essential so that we stay civil in our societies, and, you know, garbage has to be cleaned up, people have to get medical care, you know, we have to have the food trucks come in to bring us our food, all these things have to happen. But within that is a real, often unconsciousness to how we are moving through life. One of the best movies, actually, that really depicts this beautifully, it was way ahead of its time, was The Matrix. Did you see that with Keanu Reeves? Right.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, oh, I just got shivers. Like, that movie, believe it or not, is one of the most accurate pictures for displaying how unconscious most people are. And even people who think they're very conscious are often still in this soup of unconscious survival patterns. Because there's a lot of people successful who are living in survival physiology, and that survival physiology is driving their success. And we can say that it's some of these people have really given the world amazing things. But when we look at a lot of these people's histories, there was severe trauma. I mean, Steve Jobs is a good example of that. He had a highly traumatic upbringing, and that drove him to have the control, the perfection, but also this innovation to create something that was different, better. So it's kind of like a weird double-edged sword in a way.
Yeah, absolutely. And another aspect of that that I see when I work with spiritually conscious entrepreneurs is they know how to be in that higher level of consciousness. They know how to connect with their soul, with their higher truth, but they really struggle to translate who they are into the 3D, into the physical reality, because it is so jarring and off-putting to be told from such an early age that who you are as a soul is inappropriate or wrong or doesn't matter.
Yeah. Yeah. That's a great point. That's a great point. And this is a question posed to me in one of my groups a while back, but I won't get it 100% right, but something like, how do we, is there, like, how do we find our true self, right? And what does that entail? And the interesting thing is that to find something that was never there to begin with, at least like in the physicality of three-dimensional earth worlds, you know, if it was never there because we were conceived, and the moment we were conceived, mom was in her own stress and in her own traumatic responses, that, whether you want to call it embryo, fetus, baby, whatever, was being born via stress chemistry, right? And we could say, oh God, isn't that depressing to think that we've never had that beginning? And yet what we now know through science and through free will, right? And through making choices and our higher brains, we can shift out of these responses that have been with us since inception and really start to unpack, well, who am I? And what am I? And what is my pattern, because it was given to me due to how I was brought up? And what do I see in the world that I really love? You know, what is, and this goes back to that idea of internal drive, like what drives me internally? And it can be, it can wrap a person up into a lot of, we would call it maybe existential crises, where they may go inside, Emma, I've seen this happen, and there's nothing there. And it's not because they're at peace. It's because there truly is nothing there. There has been never a map, a neurological, neurochemical, biological map written that is driven through pure, like, human goodness. It's always been written out of survival. And this is why when I see a lot of my clients who think they've been doing a lot of good work, and they have, because it's kept them alive, it's kept them being successful, they've, you know, done really good things. But when they want to go that next step, you know, to quote The Matrix, to take that red pill and really see what's on the other side, they may find that there's nothing there. And so when you come to that realization, and again, that's why that movie is so beautiful, when Keanu Reeves, when Neo actually saw what was there, if you can remember, it was pretty dark and gray and drab, right? There wasn't a lot of color in the real world. The Matrix was what was so beautiful. And so we have to, at that point, start to look at, well, what can we find? What can we connect to? And this is where working at that level of the nervous system and the somatic body, like the actual body system, the felt sense, provides people with an anchor. Because believe it or not, our body is here and there's stuff going on in it. And so if we can listen to it, that's kind of the starting point to truly figuring out who we are. Just like an infant, when they're born, all they know is what their digestion is feeling, believe it or not. Like a baby pretty much lives off of what their GI tract is saying to them. It's in our world, we would say that the GI tract, the digestive system, is actually the first brain, because it is online and functioning when we're born, more so than anything else. And so one of the ways to, you know, to give some people hope is that when you feel like, oh shit, there's nothing there, this is why working now with the somatic self, the body, the felt sense, is becoming kind of a hot topic right now, because it is something that's tangible. It is there. It's not in the clouds. It's not in our higher brain. It's like in our system. That makes sense?
It does. It does. And it is a hot topic now. Can you speak into your understanding of how someone who really has been disembodied or separate from their body, how someone can start to get into relationship with their body so that they can be listening?
Yeah. Well, one of the most simplest practices I would give to someone, and as I say this, you can do it right now, is just to feel the weight of your body against whatever it is you're resting on. So that could be your chair, maybe you're sitting on a couch, maybe you're standing, maybe you're lying down. And to really feel the physical mass of your bones, of your tissue, your muscles, your entire body system, and it making a pressured contact with what you are on. And as simple as that might be, I often find that when I ask that question, 9 times out of 10, maybe 8 or 7, depending on the audience I'm talking to, they weren't even aware that they had this physical body that was in contact, like sensorily, with the chair they were on, because they're listening to me or they're listening to you. They're in their higher brains, and we haven't been taught to be in our higher brains and in our body simultaneously. And we're even taught to go to those yoga classes and all this and be fully embodied, but not be in our higher brain. And what we really want to do is be able to have both happening at the same time. So that would be one of the first things, is just to really, the word we use is orient, to direct our attention to that physicality. And then the next thing would be to notice, as you're like sitting there, what do you see around you? And Emma, I know you did some of my earlier programs. You would have learned about orienting, if you can recall that. So this ability to just take in what you see around you and to slowly move the eyes, move the head, and see specific objects. That it could be something as simple as the pen that's sitting right beside you, or a picture on the wall, or a plant, or the sky outside. So to have these sort of dual awarenesses of contact with the physical world, like that you are this three-dimensional being, there's weight to you, let the ground under you support you. Often when we're sitting, there's this tendency to like contract and try to hold ourselves together, which is very conditioned into us. So to just kind of let ourselves just be supported by whatever we're on, and then at the same time connect with the external world while noticing our contact with the external world. That's sort of one, I would say, practice to kind of dive into that first step. That makes sense?
Yeah, it does. It does. Yeah. And I'm also thinking, as you give that example, I'm thinking about all of the entrepreneurs that I've spoken with who know how to be fully in the past. And what has happened for them, they know how to be fully in the future, which generally, from their perspective, involves a lot of fear of the unknown, but they do not know how to be in the present moment.
Interesting. That's interesting. I like that, because that the one thing that when you get deeper into this work, so, you know, you asked at the very beginning, what is trauma? And then I said, it's in the nervous system. It's dysregulation of the nervous system. So when we're dysregulated, we can't be in the here and now. We cannot be in the present moment, because we are, as you said, worried about the future and thinking about the future, planning the future, and then we're looking at the past, and often that past has brought us good things, but also not good things. And so it's hard to fully just rest in the moment. The interesting thing is that when we start to work with healing that dysregulation, being in the present moment has lots of kind of goodness to it, but also lots of, to use the term lightly, like holy shit moments, like, oh my God, like every time I try to do something in the present moment, I now notice that I tense up here, or I hold my breath here. And so part of this work, and really I would call it rewiring these patterns, it's kind of like, it's not this linear process. There's a lot of stops and starts. It can be clumsy. It can be messy. It can be frustrating. Often when we're worried about the past or the future, or really, you know, ruminating on the past, looking to the future and worrying about it, we're creating a lot of survival energy that doesn't have to be there. And yet when we drop into the present moment, we sometimes realize, wow, there's a lot of survival energy right now in my system. And then that's where we kind of have to sort of dive in and then work with that.
The next question that I know someone's going to be thinking right now is, okay, Irene, that's awesome. I'm totally willing to rewire my patterns, but how much time is that actually going to take?
The rest of our lives. I say that jokingly, but with seriousness. And I'm going to tell the truth, because we have to tell the truth. I've been in the self-help industry since I started fitness, like back in 97. And one of the reasons I got out of the fitness industry and the nutrition industry, because I was also doing nutritional consulting, is that there's this desire to fix everything in a finite amount of time. Like, okay, I got 2 months to lose 10 pounds, right? Before the beach, whatever. And we know how that works out, right? It often doesn't. It might work for those 2 months, but then what happens after the 2 months? And so one of the things that has become crystal clear is that this is a lifestyle shift. It literally is, to go back to the matrix, it is deciding to take that red pill, which is opening up to the truth and the things we've been hiding and the things that we haven't been focused on. What I've seen is it depends on a person's history, Emma. So someone had pretty good attunement when they were young, because there are people out there that have secure attachment and attunement. And let's just say they had a really bad car accident when they were in their 20s. And they're like, you know, I think there's still something from that accident. You know, I almost died. I had surgery. The surgical trauma is real, by the way. So anybody here who's had surgeries and been under anesthesia, that can hold a lot of fear in the body, because we're not meant to go under anesthesia, basically. So had to throw that in there. So let's say someone had that early wiring that was pretty good enough. You know, they were safe, et cetera. They were allowed to be rambunctious and playful, but they still had boundaries and rules, all that good stuff. For someone like that, if they decide, you know what, I got to unpack some of these car accidents I had, or that one car accident, something like that could actually be worked through in a matter of a few sessions, believe it or not, with a really good trained somatic experiencing practitioner who can bring a person through the steps of that accident and really somatically release what's still being held. Okay, so that's number one. If someone is more on the other camp where they know mom and dad were stressed, they know that they weren't allowed to be who they were because they had to be perfect, they had to stay quiet, that kind of thing, that's going to take a little longer, because there were senses of unsafety and threat, not just on one car accident day, but through their entire childhood. You following me here? That makes sense?
Yep, okay. Totally.
So when someone has this sort of representation, and there's a few other factors that I'll go into in a second, that can take a few years. That could take 5 years. That could take 10 years. But it doesn't mean that within the first 6 months, there isn't noticeable shift, right? If we didn't see something change, nobody would do this work and I wouldn't have thousands of people coming into my work all around the world. Like, it does change within months, within a few years. But the key is that we have to accept the fact that our early wiring wasn't the best, which means that we have to keep working at it. But it also means that as we keep working at it, it actually gets easier. My husband is a good example of that. His name's Seth. I have free rein to talk about him. He's given me permission because he and I had very different upbringings. I had the secure attachment growing up. My traumas came later in life. He didn't. He was born premature. He had a very abusive and emotionally bad upbringing. And his patterns are stronger in dysregulation. And so he has to work at it a little bit more. He has to take more timeouts for himself, you know, because his system just doesn't have that robustness that I did. Doesn't make us better or worse. We're just wired differently. And so he's accepted. He's taken that red pill and be like, okay, this is, I need to take care of myself in a different way than Irene does. I am more like, you probably know Gary Vaynerchuk, the hustle guy. You follow him at all? So Gary is a good example of this. He works like a crazy man and people are like, how does he do that? You know, there's no way that, you know, anybody, there's something we're not seeing. He talks about how well he was parented, even though he was parented in a very stressful environment in the USSR, Soviet Russia, he had strong wiring when he was young. And because of that, he has the robustness and the vitality because he had good early nervous system wiring. And that is a real factor. And we have to know what was our wiring like. This is where education, Emma, is super important. That's why when I work with my clients, they learn like deep, deep science about their nervous systems, way beyond what we've done today. So they know where do they fit in these categories. And how are they going to have to create their world so that they have proper time off, they have support, they have all the things set up so that they can do their really great work and not play victim to these survival mechanisms that have been running the front of their bus since they were young. So all that to say, it depends on the person and where they're at. I can say without a doubt that if someone knows that they were brought up in that kind of early misattunement, it wasn't very safe, maybe there was actual abuse, you know, physical, sexual, verbal, and let's say someone listening to this is still fairly healthy, you know, like they haven't had any digestive problems, no immune system problems, they can sleep. But they know that there's that, and there's like a low-level anxiety and fear that they carry with them. The research is pretty conclusive, and that sooner or later, and I don't say this to be mean, just the research, eventually sickness will fall upon those people, whether it's mental, whether it's physical. There's something called the ACE study. Have you come across that in listening to my stuff, the Adverse Childhood Experiences study?
Yes, but can you explain that a little bit to listeners?
Yeah, so kind of the Cold Notes version or the Cliff Notes version is, it is pretty much like conclusive, and this is research that was done in California in the 80s. The research came out in the 90s, like the results, and then this study has been duplicated in multiple countries around the world, that when there is early trauma, early adversity, and usually it's this, it isn't, again, necessarily physical sexual abuse, but mom was a little unwell. There was some kind of energetic tension in the household. Maybe there wasn't enough food. Maybe there was verbal abuse, not enough money, et cetera. We know that when that occurred early in life, they're called adverse childhood experiences. Look up a study, you'll find it all over the web. If that trauma, if that dysregulation in the nervous system is not treated, it will result in chronic illness later in life. It is just proven. And so what we know is that a lot of, believe it or not, heart disease, cancer, autoimmune, depression, addictions, even things like use of IV drugs and So much. There's so much that's packed into this study that they've looked at. We will end up getting sick. It comes back to what I said earlier about genetic predisposition. If that cup has been full our entire lives and we're not doing anything to take the water out and make that container stronger, eventually it will crack. So I say all that to say, your initial question was, how long, how do you do this? It takes time, and it really depends on what your early wiring was like. And, you know, if the wiring was a little trickier when you were growing up, it's going to be a little more work to unravel, rewire, unwire, build a new map, literally, to rebuild a map within your nervous system so that your body can really sort of flourish and thrive. And it can happen. That's the cool thing. I've watched my husband, who fits into that adversity kind of matrix or adversity situation growing up. He's now making, you know, I'm not going to say the numbers, but he's doing really well. He has a private practice. And here's a guy that went from having complex PTSD when I met him, hated money, thought it was evil, you know, didn't want to work, didn't pay his taxes, nothing. Like, he was kind of that renegade hippie living in the woods when I met him. And now he goes to the office, he sees clients, he makes money, he's got a car, like, he's living here in this beautiful world with me. We're raising his stepson, or my stepson, his son, in a really good way. And so he's a good example of someone that had all those issues and has been able to wire them. The final thing I'll say with that is that the reason he's been able to do it is he's had a supportive partner, i.e. me. So he created it too because he put himself into an environment that was conducive to those changes. Does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. And I know there are a lot of people, myself included, in the past where I would attract the same pattern.
Yes.
And a partner of what I had experienced in childhood. And then there would not be healing, but it would feel familiar to me and in some level comfortable to me to be in that state where I was repeatedly abandoned and betrayed.
Yeah, because if that's how you were wired when you were young, that actually is safe, right?
Right.
That is safety. That is love, being betrayed, abandoned, and shat upon, essentially, to be, you know, vulgar about it.
Totally. Totally.
This is where we, and so, like, here's this situation where a person, that's their norm, that's safety. They then come into a situation where they're being cared for, they're being treated well. That is going to cause anxiety. That's going to cause confusion. And this is where people often, we call it flee from health. They'll all of a sudden feel something that seems so wrong and so not right that they go, well, this can't be true. But the thing is that higher brain is listening to their survival system saying, this isn't normal. This isn't normal. This is danger. Well, when actually what they think is danger is the safest thing they've ever experienced.
Yes, right. And it plays out in business as well, because for someone who comes from scarcity and is used to being in fear, for them to all of a sudden start receiving abundance, start receiving more money than they ever could have imagined, it feels threatening to them. And they will often go into this pattern of self-sabotage because it's so unfamiliar, even though it's what they say that they want.
You hit the nail right on the head there. It's true. I've seen highly successful entrepreneurs make millions, you know, and help a lot of people along the way, but the foundation in which they made that money was so shaky, and it was because of lack. It was kind of, in many ways, a way of proving. You know, and in that, you, of course, helped a lot of people, but for that to sustain, a pattern has to be established that that is responsible with, let's say, that money, that knows what to do with it, that doesn't throw it all away. And it's a tricky one, right? Because it often that pattern isn't seen until they've lost it all once or twice. And hopefully that pattern can be seen, and then they can make some more cognitive behavioral-based changes to get better help at managing that, if we want to call it, say, money. But it's really managing risk. It's managing safety. It's managing what we're comfortable, uncomfortable with. I think it's fascinating, actually. Like, we could talk for hours about this. But it's what I've seen 100%, I'd say 10 times out of 10, when someone can really learn how their patterns are driving them from this base level, early nervous system level, if they're really interested in getting deep, like this is as deep as it can go, really, I think, things start to become kind of fun, because it sustains in a way that is almost hard to write on paper. It's like it's a true energetic alignment. You know, we talk about alignment all the time, but when we get to that level of working at the nervous system and cleaning up these wiring patterns that aren't just in our generation, they go back generations, right? Generations and generations. But when we can start to really rewire in the way that we can for the goodness and internal drive, because we really want to be a person that's offering to the world, and we're going to do this from a place of internal drive, not because I'm trying to feel better about myself. Stuff starts to change really in a cool way from my experience. You know, does that make sense? Like, we end up meeting the people we need to meet. Opportunities come when they're supposed to. We could call that, you know, the full on, the secret, you know, like true alignment, but it's at this deeper level that I think is really cool personally.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm so glad you lifted that up, because what you just shared about is exactly why I'm doing this podcast series, because we cannot get to the point in our businesses where we're self-sabotaging out of our own learned patterns of behavior. So this is really about taking a stand for all of you listening to this episode to build your business in a sustainable way. And that begins with building your life down to a cellular level, to your nervous system level, in how you show up in the world, how you choose to be present in the world.
Yeah. And I'll say one more thing to that, is that I've talked a lot about regulating the nervous system, and of course we can't get into all the inner details, but it comes down to having good regulation of the sympathetic and parasympathetic, and that's essentially activation and deactivation. Like, we need to have energy, we need to have that adrenaline get us going, because we need it, right? It's not a bad thing, but then we also have to bring it down. And when we can get that in our own personal physiology, and it's healthy and it's not reactive to things that come at us, it's regulated, that then oozes into how we do our business. And we end up creating a regulated business where there are ups and downs. There's going to be stressful times. But then, I mean, for me as a business owner, I manage about 12 contractors, it's a lot of people. And when I used to manage that from a more kind of frantic, survival-based way, it was exhausting, right? Because you're constantly putting out fires, and I won't get into it, but it's exhausting. But when you can see these problems, because there's going to be problems come up and things you have to troubleshoot, if you can stay embodied, regulate in your own system, connect with the environment, connect with yourself. Notice if you're carrying tension when you're writing that email or writing that proposal or paying your bills or whatever. If you can shift out of that threatening energetic and into a more regulated energetic, that energy ripples out and people feel it. Like it shifts things. And it makes people not only, you know, if you have employees, they want to work for that kind of energy. You know, you keep people when you are in that. It's like being a good attuned mother, really. Like you are, like the parents who are lovely and attuned, those kids like being with their parents, right? But the parents right. that aren't attuned, that's where you get the problem teenagers. Like that's where you have rebellion. It's not because that's what teenagers are supposed to do. They're rebelling because they were never, their needs weren't met when they were young, and now they're old enough to say, screw you, I'm out of here. Right. Mm. But they couldn't until they were old enough to have their own money, to have their own transport. So when you're running a business, it's the same way. Like if you come from that regulated space, people will want to work for you. People will do lots for you, and not in a way that's excessive and because you're their guru. You know, it's because they just want to be around that energy, and it's quite potent mm-hmm. when you get it at that level.
Yeah, I absolutely agree with that. And Irene, mm-hmm. thank you so much. This has been completely juicy. Love cool. the paradigm shift that you offered.
How can
people learn more about you?
Yeah, it's pretty simple. Just my website, irenelyon.com. Lyon is spelled like the city in France, so it's just a Y. Or you just Google me, and there you'll find more about my history, my blog, every social media icon you can imagine is there. So I've got a really popular YouTube channel. I'm doing a lot more on Instagram these days. I really like Instagram. Twitter, not so much. And Facebook. I've got a thriving Facebook community of about 20,000 people, I think. And my team moderates that group. So if you've got questions, you post the question, and then we approve them with our answers. And then also on my site, a person will find the two online programs I do. I know you did the self-study one. It's a 21-day tune-up. And then I'm starting to do more live events where I'm bringing in my Feldenkrais background and collaborating with a whole bunch of other folks to teach people about all this stuff, about movement and the nervous system and healing. And there you
awesome.
Go.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Awesome. Thanks so much for being with us today.
You're so welcome. Thanks for asking.
Are you a conscious entrepreneur who has hit a financial ceiling in your business? Do you find yourself up in the middle of the night wondering where your next sale is going to come from? Do you struggle with working harder and harder yet not getting better results? Do you have a deep desire to take your business to the next level, but you aren't sure how to get there? If so, let's talk. I offer 30-minute complimentary consultations specifically designed to help diagnose what's keeping you from growing your business. To schedule your consultation, go to emmachurchman.com/consult Emma.